Shumrabyug.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Shurlook. Shurlisten, the podcast that takes a pop at culture.
Shurlook.
Shurlisten.
Shurlook. Shurlisten.
Shurlook. Shurlisten.
Shurlook. Shurlisten.
Shurlook.
Shurlisten.
Shurlook. Shurlisten.
Shurlook. Shurlisten.
Oh, very good, Benetron. It's me, Mictimus Prime. But look, we don't have time to get into our characters for this week's podcast because we've loads of things to look at, including Marvel are advertising comic books as though they're movies these days, which is exciting, isn't it, I think? Also, M. Night Shyamalan has done a movie about the terror of being a single dad going to a Taylor Swift concert, and we've had a trailer for the new film Transformers 1. But look, that's not all, because I've seen, what's it called again? Rebel Moon 2, The Scar Giver. And I've seen the latest episode of X-Men 97.
Michael, if that wasn't enough for a weekly pop culture podcast, and it isn't.
No, it's not.
We're going to be taking a look, Michael, at what's going on with all these sexy bloodsuckers. What is this? Why are these vampires too damn sexy?
Why are they so sexy, these vampires, all the time? Benjamin, look it. We have to tell the listeners, the loyal listeners, we're recording this on a Sunday. We usually record this on a Monday. So if anything enormous has happened on Sunday night or Monday, we haven't seen it. That's why we're not reacting to it.
Yes, that's why we've kept shtum.
Yeah, so if Bob Iger has announced that he's shutting down Disney and we're not going to say anything about it, that's why.
If Bob Iger announces that every single person on the Disney payroll is going to be replaced by AI, this is why we haven't talked about it.
We haven't talked about it because it hasn't happened yet from our perspective, because time, to the human eye at least, is linear. But Benjamin, speaking of the linear progression of tales, it looks like we've circled all the way back to the early 2000s and the Ultimates are back.
The balls on Marvel Comics, Michael, for bringing back the Ultimates. The fucking cojones this has taken.
Everybody loved and then very quickly afterwards hated the Ultimates.
Hated them, Michael. Michael hated them.
No, loved first, though. Don't forget, loved first and then hated. Benjamin, sometimes you need the love of something deeply in order to truly and passionately hate it.
You reckon?
No, I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I think that's something that people say when they have like a Joker and Harley tattoo on their upper calf.
Yeah, because look at it this way, Benjamin, for example. We famously at this podcast hate racism, but we didn't go through a period of thinking racism was the best.
No, that's never happened, actually, surprisingly, for us. Yeah, never, yeah, don't, never gone through that period.
Don't look up either of our internet histories, please. But look, Benjamin, the Ultimates is back. It was out in the early 2000s, and the early 2000s, it was Captain America, but this time Captain America was saying fuck. And there was Iron Man, there was the Wasp, there was Gigantic Man, there was the Hulk, but the Hulk had no undies on.
None.
And I'm sure there was someone else. Thor! But Thor was a mentally ill, escaped mental patient from Norway.
Yeah, who drank Heineken a lot? Or Carlsberg?
I don't know, whatever the big product placement of the time was.
Yeah. So, look, there's very few things that have stood the test of time from the Ultimates universe, aside from Black Nick Fury.
Black Nick Fury?
And Miles Morales.
Miles Morales is from the Ultimate Universe, you're absolutely right. You say very little of it has stood the test of time, but the Avengers film, Benjamin, do you remember the Avengers film from 2012?
Yes, Michael, a seminal moment in your young life.
Yes, I was in my 30s, but yes. And that film is closer to an Ultimate Universe Avengers movie than it is to a Marvel 616 1960s Avengers movie.
That'll get you in trouble now.
I don't think it will. I think that's a fair enough thing to say. Because the Ultimates introduced the whole notion that the Avengers were a government-sponsored super team and that they were brought together by Black Nick Fury to face. You know, there was a lot of the DNA of that Ultimates run in that movie. Now, I think they took the good things and discarded the bad things. Like, for example, the brother-sister fucking.
Yeah, they got rid of that. Less they of got that rid between of Wanda and Pietro Maximoff.
They got rid of that. They got rid of the blob eating the wasp.
Yeah, that famous, wonderful scene that we all actually had to read at one point. Yeah, that didn't scare me.
Yeah, look, the Ultimate Universe went down the route of excess and people ended up not liking it. So it's about time we got a reboot, but we're getting a reboot. And it's odd looking. It's kind of nearly the normal universe, but not.
So I think this is tied in very loosely, Michael, with this the Ultimate Spider-Man number one that we got there recently that we both reviewed on this very podcast. And I think the idea is somebody has stopped heroes from reaching their full potential. I believe it's the Maker who
is... It's the Maker. It's that bad old Reed Richards again.
Yeah, so the Maker, actually, sorry, three things have survived the test of time from the Ultimates universe. The third one being the fact that their Reed Richards went absolutely fucking nutso and became the Maker.
Yeah,
and now plagues everybody. Yeah, plagues everybody.
Bad bloke.
He's a real bad egg. But yeah, so that's happened, and he has stopped heroes from reaching their full potential is the concept. And I think this is about an alternate universe Tony Stark fixing timelines?
Yeah, or a future Tony Stark who's managed to figure... I think, and this plot line carries through from the Spider-Man comic, it appears to be that in the future of this universe, Tony Stark has figured it out, and he's sending messages back in time to try and activate heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, that to me, Benjamin... That to me says there's a big twist coming on that maybe it's not Tony Stark, maybe it is the Maker or an alternate Reed Richards or something. I suspect a twist coming. But anyway, have you got the lineup of the team there?
Yeah, so it's a really weird lineup, actually. Thor is there again.
Oh, yeah.
He's hanging out. Captain America is dead, but not your dad's Captain America. Fucking cursing Captain America, because it turns out things in the 1940s... not great all the time.
Is this the one who says fuck?
Yeah, this is the one who says fuck all the time.
Oh my gosh, imagine.
Yeah, I know. Such shock, Michael, such shock. Bloody Ant / Giant Man is there.
Oh yeah, he's one of everyone's favourites.
He's hanging out there. Looks to be Valkyrie or some variation of Sif is hanging out.
It's Sif. It very much looks like 616 Sif.
It's probably...
She's got the dark hair, red and white costume. Looks every inch your common or garden Sif.
Probably Sif, right? Then we have the Wasp. She's knocking about there.
Oh, yeah. Pre-being eaten by the blob.
Yes, pre-munch Wasp. I don't know if they're going to keep the bizarre Hank Pym beats the shit out of his wife on a regular basis and she constantly comes back to him because I'm Mark Miller storyline.
Yeah, they probably
I don't know
won't.
If that's being kept.
I don't think that's going to fly in the year of our Lord 2024, Benjamin.
Probably not. Probably not, Michael. Then, the really kind of controversial curveball in the lineup, Michael, there's a bloody Doctor Doom there.
Oh, is that not just a young Iron Man?
Oh, I don't know.
Is that an Iron Lad? I thought it was some sort of Iron Lad. I thought the implication was perhaps that Tony Stark had managed to contact young Tony Stark and said, do a big Iron Man, you little bollocks.
Come here to me and I'll give you all the secrets that I had to work very hard to get, but now I will pass on to you in true Nepo baby fashion.
He's his own Nepo baby. Iron Lad is Iron Man's own Nepo baby.
Yeah. I mean, look, it remains to be seen, Michael. I have to be honest, this gimmick of a very quick motion comic to sell comics, I found it very jarring. I didn't find it very good.
Oh, did you not? I like it. I'd watch a show that was just a voiced comic doing a motion comic. I'd say I'd watch.
That was...
I have watched.
Yeah, you have, because they did that with The Ultimates for a while. There were a few motion comic versions of The Ultimates released on DVDs that were just motion comics with a bit of voice acting thrown in.
Yeah, everyone was saying fuck and having no underpants on.
Ah, fucking terrible stuff. So I mean, look, the Ultimates universe gave us a lot of stuff, Michael, and I have to say I was very taken in by it. I loved Ultimate X-Men in the first initial couple of runs. I thought it was a very good comic, but over time, Michael, they all kind of fell off. They all kind of spiraled a little bit into weird territory.
They all went a bit wonky. I think one of the fantastic things about the Ultimate universe was you learned that a lot of comic book writers are great at coming up with initial concepts or playing well in a universe that is already established, but there are very few of them who are good at both.
Yes, it's a true rare being that can do it all in the comic book universe.
Mm. And the Ultimate Spider-Man was great for quite a long time. The X-Men was pretty good, but went off the rails when they started introducing new Wolverines and different timelines, and they did a whole Age of Apocalypse thing with Robert Kirkman, and then went, nah, didn't like that, undo it, never happened. And just retconned it in its own final issue.
Yeah, it was like, I always remember that. They introduced out of nowhere, Michael, that Apocalypse was a thing, and then it turned out to be a Danger Room simulation at one point. And this was a character that one of the X-Men had created?
Was it? I thought... Now, Ben, this is nearly 10 years ago, if not more. I thought that the Phoenix beat Apocalypse or something and then just retconned everything and said, all of that didn't happen. No, don't worry about
You're absolutely right. So, what I'm thinking of, the weird thing that I'm thinking of is they introduced Mr. Sinister in the Ultimates universe. Do you remember this?
No.
Okay, so Mr. Sinister, as it turns out, in the actual X-Men run, Michael, very intimidating figure, huge range of superpowers, very sinister, as the name might suggest, yeah. Quite a bad egg all right. The X-Men Ultimate Universe, they introduced him as a tank top wearing, dual gun wielding emissary of Apocalypse with dissociative identity disorder, DID, and initially, Apocalypse was a god that he prayed to, but it turns out it was just a totem made up of, like, hockey pads and things that this very mentally ill man had discovered in the street.
Very,
very strange.
Edgy. Benjamin, speaking of mental illness, we got a new trailer for a new film this week from your favourite director and mine, M. Night Shyamalan, starring your favourite actor and mine, not Ashton Kutcher.
Yes, not Ashton Kutcher, otherwise known as the good egg Ashton Kutcher, Josh Hartnett.
Josh Hartnett, Benjamin. He's not doing a lot of projects, so it's very interesting when you see him in a project. And in this, he's playing the terrifying M. Night Shyamalan-esque role of a dad taking his teenage daughter to a popular music concert.
Is there anything scarier, Michael? I don't think so.
Ben, I think that this entire film preys on that feeling of being out of place and being predatory of being an older man at a thing that's mostly attended by younger women.
Well, from the looks of this trailer, Michael, it's certainly not going to do dads taking their daughters to concerts any favours.
People are already looking at them with suspicion, going, are you her dad or are you her sugar daddy?
Have you groomed this young woman? What's going on?
Yeah. Or are you secretly a sex murderer?
And in the case of this trailer, yes! Josh Hartnett, you are.
So the interesting proposition that this trailer seems to be asking us to get on board with is the tension of this is going to come from us being privy to the serial killer's the gauntlet of emotion he's going to run while being there and himself being hunted.
Yeah, so I think in true M. Night Shyamalan fashion, he has come up with a scenario, Michael, whereupon, and it's outlined very clearly in the trailer, this entire concert is a booby trap for a serial killer known as The Butcher.
Great serial killer name, very original.
Very original, Michael. Very M. Night Shyamalan. So, they've spent an egregious amount of money, Michael.
Yeah, go on.
To set up not an intimate small concert venue.
No.
But a fucking stadium.
I don't know if it's a stadium. It's not. I don't think it's a stadium. It's like an arena. It's more like the Point
Depot. It doesn't matter, Michael.
The Aviva. It absolutely matters, Benjamin. The seating capacity of that looks to be about 4,000 to 5,000, not 80,000 to 90,000 of an arena. That's an order of magnitude of difference, Ben.
That's fair enough, Michael, but I would still say...
No, I'm not done on this point. No, I am. You go ahead.
Okay, well, that's good. Michael, what I would say is that, bizarrely, this is a not very logistically intelligent way to catch a serial killer.
Well, is that what we're looking for in our entertainment? Because maybe, Benjamin, maybe this is going to be a movie about paranoia. Maybe that's not what's happening.
Yes, fair. Fair.
You know, the whole point of this is that we're getting this... First of all, we're getting this through the main character of Josh Hartnett from a piece of gossip from one guy who he seems to maybe know a little bit, but not know him super well. And maybe it's not true. Maybe there's a credible bomb threat. Maybe there's a credible threat against the life of the popstrel. And that's going to be the twist, that they weren't actually hunting him at all the whole time.
And he's just a bit mad.
And he's just a bit mental and paranoid. And that's what the enjoyment is going to be for us, going on this paranoid journey and going, are they out to get him, or are they just doing their job? Is something else happening that's nothing to do with him? Is part of his psychosis of being this serial killer that he assumes everything is about him? And he only needs the tiniest little push over the edge to think that the whole thing is focused on catching him.
I don't know, Michael. It's an interesting one to say. I mean, look, Josh Hartnett does, as it turns out, a great creepy serial killer face.
Yeah, he has one of the best creepy serial killer faces.
Yes, it's most excellent, Michael. Most excellent. I really enjoyed it. But look, what's most interesting to me about this, Michael, is it's a father-daughter movie released by M. Night Shyamalan, which is surely going to go up against another Shyamalan release this summer, which is his daughter's.
His own daughter's film. Yeah, he's going to stick it to her. I think hers is coming out first. I don't think they're going to be going up against each other.
It'd be quite cruel of your superstar father to do that, though. I don't think that would be fab.
Now, look, I think they're trying to hit us with a Shyamalan 1-2 double punch whammy. I think that's really what's going on.
Yes, it's all a big marketing ploy to get us double Shyamalan. Two barrels straight to the face.
Benjamin, speaking of two barrels straight to the face, one of the things that you hated about the recent series of Transformers movies, you said this to me. You said, I wish there weren't any fucking humans in these.
That's famously not what I said, Michael. I said, I wish there weren't any of these movies, full stop.
Oh, that's what you said, yeah. Beg your pardon, Benjamin, I wasn't listening.
That's all right. It's very common for you not to listen to anything I say on this podcast, Michael.
Yep. So, Benjamin, you said, I'm being facetious here. It was Transformers fans who said that. Ever since the first Transformers movie, and I mean the first live-action Transformers movie in the year of our Lord 2007, Transformers fans, Benjamin, have been saying, stop making all of these flipping movies about fucking Shia LaBeouf and what's that woman's name? Megan Fox having a big kiss and going around and running and doing adventures. We don't want to see that. We want to see a film from start to finish about the flipping robots. Do you remember at the start of Bumblebee, you gave us that 10 to 15 minute sequence set on Cybertron during the Autobot and Decepticon Civil War? That was fabulous. That's what we, the Transformers fans, and we are a monolith. That's what we want. Give us that. So the two Has brothers, Benjamin, the Hasbro brothers, the brothers Hasbro, they said, fine, that's exactly what we'll give you. We'll give you a film which is start to finish just flipping robots on Cybertron, but we're going to make it like a modern comedy. And the Transformers fans just went, oh no.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've heard of overcorrection, Michael, when it comes to a movie's tone and general vibe, but this is insane. This is the overcorrection to end all overcorrections, Michael.
Look, listen, Ben. It's not like this is the first Transformers thing to be a comedy. The Transformers animated series from around 2010, or maybe a little bit earlier, was along the lines of this. It was a bit of a wacky madcap comedy with fun character designs. But this, in its casting choices and in its character designs, but especially in its dialogues and jokes and cutaways, this is like people have, it's like they've taken what people said was wrong with Marvel movies and made it into a movie.
Yeah. I think there's a harbinger for comedic tone shift in any film, and it's Keegan-Michael Key. I think anytime you cast Keegan-Michael Key in anything, it is the death knell of a serious tone for your film and a bigger push, I think, towards comedy, because I think that's what Keegan-Michael Key does.
Who's he playing in this?
He's Bumblebee.
Is he?
Yeah, he's Bumblebee. So it's the, I mean, if you're going to do it, right, if you're going to relaunch a beloved franchise, you may as well get Chris Hemsworth, Brian Tyree Henry, Scarlett Johansson, Keegan-Michael Key, Lawrence Fishburne, and John Hamm to voice a bunch of robots.
Get them all in there, Benjamin. Look, let's talk first of all about casting Chris Hemsworth as Optimus Prime, as he is in this film, not quite yet Optimus Prime, as he's Orion Pax. But fair play to Chris Hemsworth. Funnily enough, out of all of the main characters in this, he seems to be the one who's least doing himself doing a comedy. He's doing an Optimus Prime.
Yeah.
He's not Australian, first of all. He's gone for a... Not Peter Weller. I've forgotten who Peter Cullen. He's gone for a Peter Cullen-esque timbre to the voice. And I think, in terms of what we've had recently in terms of celebrities playing known characters and not bothering to do the voice, I'm not going to name any names, Chris Pratt. But in terms of that, this is way beyond Chris Pratt being Mario. He's definitely giving Optimus Prime a shot.
You know, he made a real effort from this, Michael. He certainly made more of an effort than Brian Tyree Henry, who was playing Brian Tyree Henry as Megatron for some reason.
It is an odd choice to have Megatron being a kind of slightly whiny, annoyed sidekick character.
When I saw this, Michael, all I could think was, what does Mick Leonard think of this? And if so, what is the actual facts behind the Transformers origins? Because where did they come from? I didn't realise that they don't start out as Transformers, or is that new?
That's pretty new to this, it seems. So, look, Ben, the fact of the matter is there are no facts of Transformers origins. Even in the original series, in the Generation 1 series, there are three or four origins. Transformers has always been murky around... Where do Transformers come from? Are they a naturally occurring thing? Were they created? Are they, you know, children of some sort of gods? Or are they the workforce of some unknowable alien overlords? And this is hinting at a little bit of all of those, because once it gets deep into this trailer, one of the biggest things that happens if we get the appearance of the Quintessons, or the Quintessons, and they're the... In one of the multitudinous origins of the Transformers, they are the master race who created the Transformers to be their worker slaves and military, their soldiers. Before the Transformers either rebelled or forgot about their origins, or, you know, retcon upon confusion upon it doesn't matter. But they're back and they're all tentacly fellas. You might remember them from the Generation 1 cartoons, where they had multiple faces and they were judges, but all the judges always said guilty.
That doesn't sound very fair as a judicial system.
No, that's the whole point, I believe. That they're really no good.
Yeah, so I thought they were Cthulhu bots. That's pretty much what I thought we were getting.
Yeah, I mean, the Quintessons are, you know, an 80s original creation from the Marvel comics or the animation. I don't know who came up with them first. But they've been around. They've got history. They kind of made an effort and considering putting them into the movie series. I think Gemma Chan's robot character in one of the X-Men, one of the Transformers movies, was called Quintessa. And I think they were going to go down the route of the Quintessons had created the robots. But again, Transformers origin, not worth getting into. It looks like they're doing a fresh start with this. I think the animation looks great. It's cool to see a Transformers movie about Transformers for the first time since 1986, which is, you know, amazing. But the tone, odd. Yeah, it seems like this has probably taken so long to make that it might have even been in production before the backlash against the punny, irreverent monologue. Everyone is funny except the one serious female character played by Scarlett Johansson. Which Scarlett Johansson, God bless her, has been typecast as. All of that excitement came from, or maybe all of these decisions were made before the public started turning against that.
I see. Well, I mean, the public turning against massive franchises is nothing new, Michael. You've seen something this week.
Yeah, Ben, look, it can't possibly be as bad as Rebel Moon 2 Scargiver by Zack Snyder on Netflix, which came out last week. Ben, I sat down and I watched this. Do you remember when I didn't like the first one?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah, this one's worse.
How can it be worse, Michael? How? But, how is that possible?
Do you remember when in the first one they went off into space and said, the baddies are coming to our village. We've got a little village of a couple of hundred people. And we live in a pre-industrial society for some reason. And we've got a couple of hundred acres of wheat. We've got about as much wheat as a couple of hundred people could harvest in 3 or 4 days manually. Like, on a galactic scale, that is roughly equivalent to zero wheat.
Yeah, interplanetary wheat supplies are notably difficult to quantify in small amounts planet-by-planet basis, yeah.
Yeah, look at it this way, Benjamin. There's not a spaceship in the universe that is going to divert itself for maybe 2 or 3 days worth of wheat.
It just doesn't make sense from a space economics point of view, Michael.
It doesn't. That's probably one of my biggest issues with this. And you could brush it off and say, oh, it's just, you know, it's something that the space baddies want. It doesn't really matter what it is that they want. So the fact that it's a trivial amount of wheat doesn't really matter. All you need to know is the space baddies are coming and they want something. And we, the space parochials, don't want to give it to them. So let's side with us. But there's one big thing in this movie that stops you from ignoring that. And that's the fact that the first hour of this film is essentially a 1 hour long space farming montage.
What do you mean?
So you get nearly an hour, the first whole hour. And I understand what Zack Snyder's attempting to do. He's trying to make us relate to these characters and like them and not want to see them killed or injured in defending their homes. So the best way to make us do that is to watch them manually go through a harvest in 3 days. So you get a couple of hundred people out in the fields in slow motion, manually harvesting wheat, threshing it, sifting it through bloody sieves, putting it into bags, collecting it all up. The first, okay, I'm exaggerating, it's not an hour, it's probably only about 40 minutes, but it's a 40 minute space farming montage.
Michael, that's not the basis for a sustainable entertainment model.
No. And, like, I think the biggest crime that this movie commits is that at the end of the last one, when they had gathered the team and gone back to the planet, the moon Velt, everyone said, oh, so the next movie is going to be the Magnificent Seven part. It's going to be the baddies come back and the goodies set up their battle plan and fight against them. And the worst crime that this movie commits is that it is exactly that. It is exactly what you would think. Nothing more, nothing less. It is exactly that story. There is not a twist or a turn. Nothing inventive or unusual happens in this. Nothing. It's almost mind-bogglingly bereft of ideas.
Michael, that sounds awful.
It's not a good film. It's really not a good film. So they bring back the 6 or 7 characters that they went and collected in the last movie. They've got Man with No Shirt. They've got Other Man with No Shirt, but who has an alcohol problem. They've got Woman with a Bit of Face Makeup. They've got Jedi, the Lady Jedi. I think that's it. Who else did they bring? I think that's everyone who survives. And they bring them all back. And they get ready and they spend an hour farming. Then they all sit around a table and have a 15-minute sequence in which each of the 6 of them tells the others their backstory, Ben. Now, there are visuals, there are flashbacks, but everyone has the same fucking backstory. Everyone's backstory is, I was on my planet, the Imperials came, they were baddies, now I want to kill them. So that's why I'm here on this planet to help.
Michael, that doesn't make any sense. You can't have 7 characters with 7 similar backstories.
You can, because none of them are characters. Look, oh my Christ, oh my God, it's so boring and trite. They spend a movie and a half, Benjamin, building us up on Jimmy the Robot. Like, oh, yeah. Jimmy the Robot's there as well. And if they can convince Jimmy the Robot to be on side, oh, who knows what might happen? Because he's like a war robot and, you know, anything could happen if they get Jimmy on side. And maybe that'll turn the tide of the whole thing. But no, just Jimmy does nothing. Half the farmers get killed. It looks like the village is going to be destroyed by a tank. And then Jimmy arrives and blows up the tank. And that's it. They made me sit through a movie and a half of what's Jimmy going to do for Jimmy to do a Superman landing and blow up a tank. That's it. That's all he does, Ben. A movie and a half of Anthony Hopkins pontificating and then he blows up a tank.
Michael, should we reach out to Zack Snyder and just offer our services as a consulting firm? Just to occasionally have him, you know, line one up and we'll just go, good, but what have you tried this, Zack? What have you tried to be interesting in any way?
What have you tried to do something cool and interesting? But, I mean, it says a lot about Zack Snyder's writing style that it's almost exactly like Jimmy's role in this is almost exactly like Superman's in Justice League. He shows up at the end, is invulnerable, does one thing, and if he'd been there the whole time, maybe would have saved a lot more people, but didn't. But that's okay, because you get the cool moment where you think everything's going to go pear-shaped, and then here comes the character that I like. He's my favourite. He's going to do something cool. Doesn't team up with anybody. Doesn't, like, do you remember in Avengers, Ben? I know Avengers isn't one of your favourite films. Do you remember how in Avengers, all of the characters, it's not one of your favourites, but do you remember how in Avengers, all of the characters got to do cool stuff about their abilities? Like,
yeah,
Captain America
showcased
has that,
what they could do.
Yeah, like Captain America has that cool scene where he shows he never gives up. He demonstrates his abilities, his strength and his speed. He's jumping through windows and kicking people. And then he has that cool scene where he commands the police and the firemen and everything and says, you, go down there, you, over there. And, you know, remember that scene? Remember that whole sequence? Or the sequence with the Hulk where he says, that's my secret cap, I'm always angry. And then he smashes the big thing and then he throws Loki and he goes, puny god. Or everybody got to demonstrate their abilities and powers and why they were useful. No one in this movie does that. That's one of the biggest crimes of it. So they've been building up this lady, Nemesis, right? She's Dunba. She's the lady with the robot hands and the two lightsabers. And her job in the plan is she's going to be in with the women and children. And it's kind of a trap for the baddies. Because the baddies are going to send their commandos to try and capture the women and children. But little do they know, the most badass sword fighter is there. She gets killed anyway.
Right.
She gets killed. Yeah.
What?
She gets killed. Yeah, she gets killed. She struggles with like four of them and eventually gets killed. Now, like the women and children don't get captured, but yeah, she doesn't. It's not badass or cool. Like, she just kind of goes out like a loser. Very sad. Oh, very upset.
Michael, that's like a golden rule. Yeah, it's like a golden rule in a Magnificent Seven film that your characters don't go out like a chump.
Remember, or they might for drama. Remember the cool guy, Benjamin, who he has no shirt on and he like can communicate with the animals? Remember that guy? What do you think he might do? Like, how do you think he might use his special abilities or, you know, his knowledge or his personality in this siege of the village by the space baddies?
I assume he goes into the wilderness.
No, Benjamin, he doesn't do fucking anything. He doesn't do fucking anything. He has two axes and no shirt on. That's all. He just fights people with normal axes. Fucking absolute rubbish.
Michael, this sounds like a shite film.
Oh, it's so fucking long and boring and nothing interesting happens. Nothing new, nothing original, nothing surprising. It's just trite, by the book, awful. Dredge. The romance between Cora and the man character, whose name I don't remember, let's call him fucking Philip, just stifled and lame and passionless kisses. I didn't even realise they'd fallen in love. And then they started kissing and I went, oh, is that right? What's led to this? Fucking terrible scenes altogether, man. Oh, just rubbish. Just a very... I tell you what, though. Looks great.
Visually stunning shite.
Yeah, visually stunning. Not visually original or anything, because like the last movie, it's just kind of Warhammer and Star Wars stuff thrown up on the big screen. But, oh, fucking dreadful. Just don't watch it. Just a waste. Looks great, though.
Michael, I certainly hope that you've seen something that might cleanse your palate after being forced to sit through that.
Oh, I think you're referring to the latest episode of X-Men 97, episode 6. Isn't colonialism bad?
It is, yes.
Now, Benjamin, you haven't seen this and you're suffering a massive delay on your end. So I'm going to mostly talk now. And you just nod and go, yeah. So after last week's episode, Benjamin, it was always going to be hard to follow up on that because what a flipping bombshell. So they decided to follow us up by showing us... Here come the big spoilers, by the way. And there's always big spoilers for X-Men. They showed us that Charlie X... Not Charlie XCX, the English singer-songwriter, but Charlie X, Professor Charles Xavier. He's not dead at all, Benjamin. He's up in space getting the ride with Empress Lilandra.
Lilandra, yes.
Yeah. So, Benjamin, look, big lore dumps on the Shi'ar in this episode. The Shi'ar are the X-Men's space aliens.
Yeah, Shi'ites more like, am I right? Am I right?
Bloody yeah. One of Ben's least favourite sects of the Muslim religion.
Stop Benjamin. That! Stop it! Well,
you said
that.
It, not me. You bloody just said it right now. So, Benjamin, the Shi'ar are... The X-Men have the Shi'ar. The Avengers have the Kree and the Skrulls, and the X-Men have the Shi'ar. But the Shi'ar have a sexy lady bird woman as a president. Lilandra, and she finds Charles Xavier particularly sexy. And he's up there in space and he's getting the ride off her and he's like, I'm not going back to my X-Men because I'd love to get the ride.
Look, there's not a man among us, Michael, who probably would go back to the X-Men and the racism-filled planet that they left behind for the ride.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, Benjamin, anyway, you're going to have to edit this joke out. That's why you went to Belfast, famously. So, Benjamin... Ben has laughed so much the lights have gone off in the room. Benjamin, that's the A plot. The B plot is Storm and Forger back at it. They're fighting that bloody creature, that owl monstrosity.
Yes, the adversary.
The adversary. So, it's Life Debt Part 2, and it's Charles Xavier in Space Part only. And really, what it is, side stories to get some players back on the board... So that we can really have our big finale three-parter, I think. Two-parter.
It's a classic layup episode, Michael. A layup episode.
It is a layup episode. Like, there's lots of lore. There's lots of good stuff happening. There's lots of not as great stuff happening. It's a weaker episode, for sure. There's some great stuff with the Shi'ar. Gladiator, the Superman of the X-Men universe, gets a bit of characterization and gets a bit of stuff to do. And he's... cool, like he's not a goodie, but he's cool and he's interesting and he's supermanning about the place. We see a lot of Deathbird. Lilandra is mad as a brush sister and racist.
Oh, classic.
Classic mad sister. And Charles Xavier literally lectures the Shi'ar on the pitfalls of imperialism. And this, yeah, exactly. And this was the first time that I didn't like the message of this show, because I've been kind of defending this show to other people and myself along the lines of the X-Men has always been political. The X-Men is always about minority groups, whatever minority group or, you know, isolated or marginalized minority you might represent, you might identify with. You can see yourself in the X-Men. There was hints of the civil rights movement. There was hints of early, very early gay rights movement in the X-Men. Almost any marginalized group can identify with the X-Men struggles through the power of allegory.
Okay.
But this episode, to my mind, and Ben, I'm Irish. And I have such a strong anti-imperialism leaning. We're forever sticking it to big America and big the UK and big Israel.
Yeah, fuck them all.
Fuck any imperial powers. It's the worst. But at the same time, I don't like my entertainment sitting me down and literally lecturing me. And that is what this episode, that is the big turning point on this episode, is both with Storm and Forge looking at Forge's Native American history as the mm-hmm. victim of colonization, and then Xavier sitting down three or four members of the Shi'ar Empire and single-handedly turning around their political, or trying to turn around their political system by going, colonization is bad. You shouldn't be colonizers. I think that for the first time, the show has lost its way a little bit because it didn't need to force, it didn't need to force any politics around LGBT rights, representation, anything like that, because the X-Men are intrinsically about that. But there's a little bit of backlash against this for getting up on its high horse about colonialism. And I think a lot of fans have been slightly put on edge about it because it's pushing forward the narrative that white European people are the baddies. Now, we have a somewhat unique perspective on this, being white and European, but on the receiving end of colonial history, not necessarily the giving end.
Arguably colonialism's guinea pig, if you want, Michael.
Yeah, the test bed of white European colonialism.
Yeah, but
you know,
that's interesting. I suppose, Michael, what you're saying is they're leaning on a bit more on tell, don't show there, which is the opposite of what you're supposed to do.
Well, it's the opposite of what I have always liked about this cartoon. This, like the X-Men cartoon of the 90s, Benjamin, probably informed my politics in a lot of ways because I was a child being exposed to, hey, don't hate people because they're different. That's bad. But it was never, and I mean, don't hate people because they're different. That's bad. Don't go to other planets and kill everyone and take their stuff. Also bad. Don't do that either. But the fact that Charles Xavier brings in Rudyard Kipling and references him a couple of, references him a couple of times as an apologist for colonialism, which he was, honest.
He was.
He calls Gladiator a bit of a Kipling. So, yeah. So, you know, again, my beef with it, my slight beef with it, is the X-Men isn't about colonialism.
No.
It is about not hating people because they're different. And it is about, like, I don't know, maybe I'm misreading it. And, you know, it's not a be-all and end-all thing. I was just a little bit disappointed because I so loved that you couldn't tell this was a 2024 show because everything was left in the allegory, which is what is the great thing about it.
Works very well. But yeah, I suppose, look, anything coming from Charles Xavier, the man who famously turned his back on his lifelong cause, Michael, to get the ride, you'll famously remember. Yeah.
Fucking hypocrite.
Fucking.
Anyway, you know who's hypocrite. Doing them?
Go on.
It's Ross Marquand.
Ah, bloody Red Skull 2.
Red Skull 2, among others. So anytime your beloved actor won't come back and do a role, just get Ross Marquand in. He's great. Anyway, that's really all there is to say about it this week. It was an all right episode. It was, like, in terms of the grand scale of things, it's still one of the best episodes of an animated series ever done because this series is so good.
It's so damn tidy.
Exactly. But not quite up there with the Madeline Pryor episode or the Genosha episode or even the first two episodes. It was a little bit of a downturn in, felt like a setup episode, felt like getting the pieces back in place. And while we're at it, why not give people a lecture on the pitfalls of colonialism?
Just lob it in there as a little bit of extra spice.
It's literally a lecture, Benjamin. He takes them into the astral plane and sits them down like students in a classroom.
No good. No good.
Little bit on the nose for me. And I hope, and I don't know why I'm defending my own position here, but I hope that this shows that I'm consistent in my argument that I don't want my entertainment directly lecturing me about modern issues, even when it's an issue that I 100% agree with.
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. You are consistent, if nothing else.
You could probably find ways in which I'm not, Benjamin. We are, after all, only humans, unlike the X-Men.
Or, Michael, vampires.
Very good. So, Benjamin, this week's topic is, why are those vampires so sexy? So I've taken that you meant I should go back and watch the entirety of the Underworld series.
Yeah.
So we're going to ignore whatever you have to say, and I'm just going to talk about Underworld.
Oh, no, this has gone against me completely, Michael. Oh, no.
Very good. Anyway, so Underworld, the first Underworld by Len... No, I haven't. I haven't even watched them, Ben. I just had a good long think about them.
Yeah, a good, long, honest Christian think about them, Michael. Oh, I'd say even the listeners can feel the wink coming through your screen. Now, ladies and gentlemen, just in case the audio drops out there, I said,
I had a good, long think about the Underworld films, Ben. It was great.
Yes, very good. Michael, come here to me. Look, I found myself the other day, Michael, sitting here pondering the TV show Castlevania, right?
And oh, yeah, one of your favourites.
One of my favourites. Absolutely love it. 10 out of 10. Go watch Castlevania. Even go watch Castlevania Nocturne. It's a good old time. And the reason that I found myself thinking about this, Michael, is because we've gotten an announcement that, you know, they're rebooting Nosferatu, right?
Go on.
It's coming back. Robert Eggers is taking a crack at it. Willem Dafoe is in it. We're getting a period drama around a vampire. And it's going to be a big, spooky, ugly, buggly vampire. And the thing that you have to remember about Nosferatu, he's an ugly bastard.
He's fucking no crack at all, Benjamin. He's pasty, he's pale, he's got long, murdery fingers. Hold on a minute. It's me, Benjamin. I'm Nosferatu.
You are. Yeah, it's you. It's you. You're Nosferatu, with your big eyebrows and your two little teeth at the front there. And your big, long, spindly fingers. Oh, it's a horrifying image being portrayed here on the screen, Michael. But come here to me. It got me thinking.
Benjamin.
Yeah.
This is not a joke, Benjamin. I actually was called Murder Hands in college.
Well, I mean, they are. They do look like they could deal some damage, Michael.
Look at them. They definitely do a big murder on you.
There's nothing I love more than when we take our audio-based podcast and do a visual gag. It's my favourite. It really translates so well every time. Every time.
Yeah. The listeners love it.
Fab. But Michael, this sent me down a rabbit hole because it got me thinking, when did we start making vampires a bit, you know, fucking sexy? When did we get that gothic, slidey, slippery vampire going on? When did that happen?
Dracula. Did we not do an episode on this before, Ben? It was Dracula.
But Michael, it wasn't Dracula at all. We were so wrong, Michael. We were so wrong. Michael, this is the story of how a grieving mother and a spooky Irishman worked together separately across decades to create this sexy, gothic, fucking erotic-fueled vampire that has dominated our culture for the last 30 to 50 years.
Go on.
Fucking mental. So, Michael, this involved me digging around in a few different places, but you will have heard us mention on that previous episode on Dracula, Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla.
Oh, this is the one about the lesbian vampires that you're obsessed with.
This is the one about the lesbian vampires. Now, Michael, I have read this, and I never realised I read it specifically for this episode again. And I never put together how much of this...
Oh, did you have a good long think about it, Ben?
I had a good long think about Carmilla by Sheridan Le Fanu. Good long think, Michael, about it. And what's interesting about this, Michael, is, Jesus Christ, this was horny for 1872, the year it was published. Jesus, Michael. Fucking hell. Very horny. So, to get into this a little bit... Sorry, just one second. To get into this a little bit, Michael, it's quite interesting. There are two main characters in Carmilla, right? One is the aforementioned Carmilla. Okay?
And now, I was calling her Carmel the whole time.
Carmel! Come here to me, you sexy vampire. Come here, Carmel. Give us a look at you. Now, there's Carmilla and there's Laura. Now, Laura is a perfectly normal human girl. She is the daughter to an English widower who has retired after his service to the Austrian Empire. And like all great gothic novels, Michael, they live in a castle.
You have to live in a castle. That's what you did in the gothic era.
These are the rules. Must live in a castle. Now, Michael, the way that this novel is set up is very simple. She's awful lonely up there in the castle with our da, is our Laura. She's very lonely. And her da has organised for her to spend time with a young lady who is the daughter of a very important nobleman about the town.
Oh, Carmel.
No. So, unfortunately, Michael, she's very excited about this. And the novel is set up as her kind of admissions. It's her first-person account in her own diaries. It's the conceit of the novel is that she's writing 10 years on from the frightful experiences that she went through, right?
Go on.
And she's waiting for this young lady. And then they get a terrible letter. Because letters were all the fashion back in 1872, Michael.
What are the best ways to get terrible news?
One of the best ways to get terrible news, you can clutch the letter, you can weep into a handkerchief, you can stain the ink with your tears. A fantastic visual device for bad news.
Dear Mr. Leonard, I hope this letter finds you well. It is with great displeasure that I must inform you that your hepatitis test had come back positive.
Devastating.
Horrendous stuff altogether.
Yours with condolences, the least sensitive doctor on the island. Awful stuff. You'd been waiting weeks for that feedback, Michael. That should have been done in an email or a call. Why did you send a letter?
Awful pain in my liver the whole time, Ben.
Brutal stuff. Anyway, this poor young one has died. The young one that was supposed to be Laura's best pal has died. But luckily, Michael,
they've got a spare.
Who should come riding through the glen but Carmilla and her mother? And doesn't their coach only get upturned, Michael? And Carmilla is forced to stay behind in the castle while her mother continues on to business in another part of Austria.
Oh, is Carmilla sound?
Nah, she's not sound at all, Michael. The first thing that Laura notices, and this really should be a red flag in any relationship, ladies and gentlemen, very important to keep this in mind. The first thing that Laura notices about Carmilla is she looks an awfully lot is not a sentence that should ever be spoken, ladies and gentlemen. She looks an awful lot like the demonic vision that Laura had when she was 12 years old.
Oh, when I was 12 years old, I had a terrifying nightmare that I was going to be seduced into doing a long-running podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry, Michael. It turns out that's true. But that's good news, Michael, because it turns out that Laura's vision of nightmarish quality is also prophetic because she then meets Carmilla. Now, for any reader who's reading this, they go, oh, Carmilla is the vampire from her dreams. But
That's
the name of the book. But of course, Laura has some lesbian stirrings in her loins and she finds Carmilla very pretty to look at. So she says, no, can't be. This young one's too fit. I let it pass, right? Ladies and gentlemen, don't ignore red flags just because you want the ride.
Yeah, that's one of the worst things to do. That's how you end up having to get a hepatitis test.
Or you end up on a spaceship explaining colonialism to aliens. Whether you want to hear it or not. Anyway, come here to me. The heat of the read of the jig is Carmilla is in fact the vampire from her dreams, and there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens in the novel where, you know, there's a sickness sweeping around the women of the village. They're all dying. Carmilla's getting lovelier and lovelier by the day. For anyone else, they put one and one together, but every time that happens, Carmilla kind of moseys up to Laura and says, you know, I find you very attractive. And Laura goes, stop it. It's 1872. Stop it, you.
Can't have that.
there's loads of scenes, Michael, where like Carmilla's like, hold my hand and squeeze it tight. And then Sheridan Le Fanu, who's obviously having a long think about these scenes, Sheridan Le Fanu is writing things like, I couldn't stop holding her hand. My heart did quicken. It's very funny. But Michael, this is a truly scandalous account of a vampire encounter in 1872. That's about 25 years prior to Dracula. So it really is a precursor to this. And no, 15 years, not 25 years. 15 years. Terrible Ben. Bad podcast co-host.
Bad.
I'm going to have to check that now. Damn it!
Yeah, I do. I think you might be like 100 years off here, Ben.
1897. No, 1872, 1897. I was 15 years.
Yeah. 15 years, that's fine.
Surprisingly got that right. Very unusual for me on a podcast. But anyway, what happens is this becomes a really scandalous text in 1872 because it is intensely erotic and very much deals with the theme of romance and love between two women. What's also very interesting about this novel and what sets it apart from a lot of Victorian fiction is there does seem to be some kind of reciprocated love between Carmilla and Laura, in the sense that Laura is not just a meal to Carmilla. There does seem to be some kind of attraction there, some kind of draw for Carmilla outside of her being a lunchable snack at any point, right? So,
like Dracula and Wilhelmina.
Exactly, Michael. The other interesting thing that happens in this, and the other inversion of kind of a classic trope, is the men are fucking useless. And that was a very unusual thing to display in 1872. Usually men were the ones that came into the rescue of the women. Very good example of that is Dr. Van Helsing and Lucy. She has to be saved. The big strapping men who come in. There's the American.
Quincy Jones.
Quincy Jones. Quincy Jones has to come in and be like, well, I'll root and toot and ram that Dracula right up his ramboozle. And yeah, that was my American impression, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy that. But anyway, that's the way that it goes. This is a very huge text of the time. And as it turns out, in 1872, Bram Stoker obviously read this at some point and went, well, I like all this vampire business. I like all this semi-eroticism. Mm. But I tell you what I don't like. Mm. These women getting one up on the old boys. I won't have that. And then he goes on and he pens Dracula, Michael.
Oh, that's nice that you've made Bram Stoker a misogynist based on nothing.
Oh, no, he really was. It's well documented that he was quite a misogynistic chap. I'm not...
Was he?
I haven't plucked that out of the
air. Well, you know,
Sodgy. Yeah, well, but a lot of lads were at that time, Michael, but he was a Sodgy autistic corn by all accounts. But anyway, we'll get into that another time, Michael. We don't have time today. We might do The Lair of the White Worm sometime, Michael, and watch that awful movie. We might do an exhumed episode on that, will we?
It's Quincy Morris. Did I say Quincy Jones earlier?
You did, yeah. Quincy Jones. Famous jazz composer, Quincy Jones.
Yeah, jazz. Jazz. Famous jazz man, Quincy Jones. I meant Quincy Morris.
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, we both got that wrong, Michael, but very entertaining. But, Michael, this is one of the first truly erotic vampires to be brought to literature or popular culture at the time. Mm. And Carmilla steps out in a whole new way in that she very rarely becomes a horrifying creature at any point. She is depicted in dreams occasionally as a demonic cat, okay, as opposed to a wolf or a bat. But one of the important things is Carmilla is never not lovely. So what I mean by that, I'm using the 1872 definition of lovely, which is a bit all right to look at. Yeah, so we avoided that issue because in Dracula, he famously is hideous when he hasn't fed or when he's exposed to something. In this, she's only hideous when she's angry because in 1872, women shouldn't be angry. That's hideous.
Good, Benjamin. Just like these days, women are only hideous when they're angry. That's your take, isn't it?
That's
your takeaway for this episode.
God damn it. So that's what I've taken from the novel. Anyway, Michael, we would get subsequent depictions of vampires that were a little bit erotic occasionally, but usually the emphasis was far more on monster than honeybot, seducer or seductress. We didn't get those depictions. And then, Michael, many years later, came along Anne Rice.
Noted sex writer Anne Rice.
Well, I mean, yes and no, Michael. I'll be perfectly honest, right? Yes and no. Anne Rice is a very interesting case for the sexification of the vampire, right?
Right, go on.
So, we have to take 2 years into account here. What I never realised before researching this, Michael, is that Interview with a Vampire, or Interview with the Vampire, apologies, was her kind of debut novel. And that came out in 1976. Now, I never realised this, Michael. I thought it was kind of an 80s erotic horror fest. It wasn't.
No.
It came out in 1976.
No. Yeah.
And, Michael, the year previous to that was the publishing of another noted vampire classic, Salem's Lot. Right? So, Salem's Lot came out in 1975. Interview with the Vampire came out in 1976. And the depiction of the vampire in both of these novels could not be more different. Stephen King leans heavily on the classic Nosferatu representation of the vampire. And we get ugly, boogly, absolutely soul-destroying to look at vampires.
Yeah, no use at all.
No
worse
use
bunch of lads
at all. Not a great bunch of lads. But Michael, the year following that, we get some of the most erotically charged prose ever put to paper about Louis de Pontillac and the vampire Lestat.
Two handsome fellas who might do some stuff together.
Who might kiss, and boy oh boy do they. Okay, so in this particular case, Michael, it's pretty interesting. I did a little bit of reading into where Interview with the Vampire came from, and it turns out that Anne Rice at the time had written a few short stories around a similar idea. It was an interview with the vampire from the perspective of the interviewer, and then, unfortunately for Anne Rice, her daughter became very sick. Her daughter Michelle got a rare form of cancer in 1972 and subsequently passed away from that. And in order to cope with the absolute trauma of losing a child, Michael, she went back and started to rewrite these short stories into full characters, with the notable inclusion of one very key character in the Interview with the Vampire lore, which is Claudia, the child vampire.
Oh, Kirsten Dunst.
Kirsten Dunst, absolutely. And in this particular case, if we were to take it as a way of working through trauma.
Yeah, very good. Very easy to say.
Never am I more Irish than when I have to say the phrase, working through trauma.
Working through trauma. What did you debut?
That's our other podcast on how Irish males can tackle the mental health crisis and loneliness epidemic.
Start a podcast.
Just start a
scream into the ether.
Anyway, if we were to take a metaphorical approach to understanding how this helped Anne Rice with her trauma, we might come to understand that creating a vampire character that lived on despite believing it dead as a child for however many decades would be a nice way to keep your daughter's spirit alive, even if they were a blood-sucking murder machine.
I don't know if it would be nice. Sounds terrible.
It sounds terrible. Well, anyway, Michael, this took the world by storm. Interview with the Vampire became a massively popular series of books. It's inspired a whole host of sequels around this called the Vampire Chronicles, and it sprawled from Europe to Egypt, etc. Anne Rice got involved. She traveled to all these countries to start to research her books. Each one sold incredibly well. They are very divisive, okay? Because half the people that read them go, oh yeah, this is some sizzling, smoky, sexy, hot vampire shenanigans. And the other half of people going, oh Jesus Christ, Anne, just go get laid.
So prudes, in other words. Anne Rice is a porn writer, Ben.
She is.
Anne Rice is a porn writer. She wrote a series of porn, flat out, not like Interview with the Vampire, steamy, you know, almost porn. Flat out porn. Yeah. And she wrote them under various pseudonyms that she kind of admitted to in the early 2000s. Like, oh yeah, that was me. They were my one-handed books.
Oh, she wrote an absolute, the worst phrase I've ever heard, Michael.
She wrote, oh, come on, Benjamin, don't be so shy and timid. You know what a one-handed book is. It's not the first time you've ever heard that phrase. Anne Rice writes porn for women. And the Interview with the Vampire books are the soft end of it, basically.
They were the possibly publishable, fairly well-done ones. Anne Rice, of course, unfortunately, I think now passed away. Yeah, she passed away in 2021. But, yes, a bit of a peddler of smut.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, you don't have to put it that negatively, Ben. You're allowed to write pornographic books mostly for women.
Michael, that's not all TikTok is these days. BookTok is mostly pornographic books for women.
Look, but let's be honest. Let's be honest for a second, Ben.
Very good.
That's why vampires are sexy.
Yeah.
Because women, and broadest fucking strokes here, obviously, because we're discussing this in the last 10 minutes of a one-hour-long podcast, and this, you could do a master's degree on this topic. But broadly speaking, women prefer written porn.
Yes, it
women
does
like
seem to
their
be
sexiness in book form.
Yes, there does seem to be a literary bent to most women's erotic desires.
most women's erotic desires tend towards, if it is the supernatural, it's the supernatural, the fantastical, the vampires, the beast men, the all sorts of crazy and terrifying monsters, but who also secretly either love each other or the women.
Yeah, exactly. So you've kind of hit the nail on the head there, Michael, because Anne Rice would go on to inspire a host of fiction and literary pursuit that we see all the time today. We have The Vampire Diaries, we have True Blood, we have Twilight. These are all literary representations of pure primal lust in the recognizable and arguably safe personification of the vampire, because we understand what vampires do.
Well, Twilight was written by a Mormon.
Yeah, but okay, the safe personification of a very sheltered existence that someone trained. All right.
Yeah, this is what I think is edgy and sexy.
I heard a very interesting argument from the internet, Michael, on TikTok, where the representation of vampires in Twilight is actually far closer to a fairy. What Stephanie Myers has created is a bizarre fairy trope that she just packaged as a vampire, which I found very interesting, Michael. Very interesting indeed. But we'll get into that another time on the podcast. Anyway, Anne Rice goes on to inspire this huge wave, Michael, of pornographic vampiric smut that would only be given a helping hand in 1994 when Brad Pitt appeared as Louis Dupont Dulac and Tom Cruise appeared as none other than the vampire Lestat, right?
Yeah, which is French for immediately.
For immediately, right now, as in, give it to me right now, Louis, you son of a gun.
Yeah, I need one pint of blood, Lestat.
Lestat.
The most dad joke I've ever done on this podcast.
Fabulous stuff, Michael. Fabulous stuff. But come here to me. This would go on to be parodied in a whole host of places. We have seen piss takes on the Anne Rice vampire in the likes of Preacher, where bloody Garth Ennis's bizarre Irish vampire Cassidy meets someone in New Orleans who is pretending to be a gothic vampire for the purposes of luring, because Anne Rice is so highly crazed at that particular point. And there's a famous Key and Peele sketch that does a very similar thing. There are all these vampires milling about, being erotic and ethereal, and then there's one guy who's been turned, and he's just a normal guy, and he's like, do we have to do it all creepy and lechy, and like, is that necessary? It's a whole thing.
That's a great sketch.
It's a fabulous sketch. But she created the erotic vampire, and it's lasted, Michael. It's stuck with us, because what we have now is we have the new Interview with the Vampire series that's out on AMC, which is a phenomenal show, Michael, and so superior. Oh, it's very good. But Michael, it's a soap opera with some superpowers. It's a fabulous show. It's brilliantly shot. It does a really good job of portraying these sexy, emotional vampires going at it, Michael. And it doesn't so much hint at a huge homoerotic relationship. It full on goes for it. In this, Louis and Lestat are full lovers. And it's a fabulous show, Michael. It's really good. The man who plays Lestat is the Australian, otherwise known as, I'm going to read his IMDb page now, Michael, which you love me doing. I know.
Jacob Anderson?
Sam Reed, who is Leon Court. And Jacob Anderson is Louis in the show. Louis in the show. It's a fabulous show, but it's very erotically charged, and there's a lot of eroticism in it. So the sexy vampire has been maintained. But so popular is the depiction of this kind of gothic, ethereal being, from Carmilla to Louis and to Lestat and onwards, that we see it all the time. In the Castlevania series, leans heavily on the erotically seductive vampire. We get it in the actual Carmilla. It's heavily hinted at that the Carmilla of the Castlevania series, who kind of seduces and beguiles Dracula, is Carmilla from Sheridan Le Fanu's 1872 novel. And then, Michael, Castlevania takes it and runs with it in the animated series, because we get Orlok as well. And Orlok's is a continuation of that. If anything, Orlok, I think it's Orlok. I have it right. Yeah, no, it's Orlok. Orlok from that is the character that we famously mocked as being Prince in the trailer for Castlevania Nocturne. But he is kind of a fabulous combination, Michael, because he's almost a Louisiana-based, New Orleans-based person of color vampire that comes from the Anne Rice universe, but follows very much in the tradition of Carmilla. So, the idea... It's sucky. And it's funny because it's so interesting when you say, because we just said, we've just talked a little bit about Louisiana. The original Interview with the Vampire is set in New Orleans. And then the True Blood series that would follow on from that, which is a spiritual successor by any other name, is also set in Louisiana. And so there seems to be a thing for this Southern Gothic, you know, waif kind of vampire figure that just permeates throughout. But that's all because, Michael, of a horny Irishman who liked to have a long think about ghosts and a grieving mother, unfortunately. Very interesting.
Very interesting, Ben. We talked about sexy vampires for nearly half an hour and never once mentioned Satanico Pandemonium.
We didn't. We got away from that, Michael, because I was very focused on the sexy gothic vampires today.
Yeah, not the sexy Mexican vampires.
Not the sexy Mexican vampires. Maybe next time. Although Orlocks, I've gotten that right or wrong in one form or the other. It's either Orlocks or Orlok. He is a Mexican vampire. He's an Aztec vampire of sorts. So sort of a sexy Mexican vampire, Michael.
Oh, yeah. And you know, Antonio Banderas was sexy and about in Interview with the Vampire, too.
He's Armand, Michael. And he's Armand in... There's an Armand in the new Interview with the Vampire series. But anyway, we'll have to do that another time,
what
Michael. You're off to have a long...
We'll do a whole episode on sexy Mexican vampires. Right, yeah. Put it in the calendar.
Yeah, you're off to have a long think. I'm off to have a long think about vampires a bit more. But ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to talk about your long thinks about vampires, there's a few different ways you can do that.
No, we don't want to hear it.
You can get in touch with us on the interwebs at www.seomrabeag.com, SEOMRABEAG.com.
It kind of means tiny room in Irish.
Sort of a little bit, maybe. Or you can get in touch with us on our Acast website, www.sherlockshallistenpodcast.acast.com.
That's where you get all the latest podcast updates.
Yeah, they're all there. You can find us on Instagram at sherlockshallistenpodcast.
Means sherlockshallisten in English this time.
You can find us on TikTok at sherlockshallisten.
Yep.
Or, the best way to share your vampire smut with us, ladies and gentlemen, is to hop up on the Discord, linked below in the description.
Hop up on the Discord, there's a not safe for work channel. Just bang up any of your vampire smut.
Just lash it up there. Lash it up there. Alright, that's it from us, ladies and gentlemen. Bye-bye.
What are we doing next week, Ben?
Next week, Michael, we're going to take a look at characters that were intentionally written to be the bad guys that everybody missed the point of, which is also a weird retrospective review of bloody Scott Pilgrim.
Oh.
The anime series that came out on things. We're going to take a look at two works that are set decades apart, Michael, but do the same thing.
Ooh.
Ooh.
See you next week.
See you next week. Bye-bye.